We're going to start this evening. I have an ambitious amount of material to cover tonight, so I may not make it all the way through, but I'd really like to try. What lies ahead of us tonight is, as what we did last week, just to recap, last week we analyzed the psukim regarding the sins of the sons of Eli, Eli's response to them, and Shmuel's reflected glory from that episode. What we're going to try to do tonight is to try to see God's response to the whole episode, and then just take a step backwards and really ask ourselves, what was really going wrong? What was wrong with this dynamic from a bigger picture? So what we're going to do is, very briefly, is the way it's going to work is every week I'm just going to give another handout, which is going to be a continuation of some sources on the text. Already in the folders, you have the text, and we're going to build up. This is like unit 2.2. So we're going to do end of Perek Beis today. The psukim that we're going to cover are the psukim all the way leading to from Pasuk Chav Zayin until the end of the Perek, which is Pasuk Lamed Vav. So we're going to do these 10 psukim and then consider things. So let's start at the beginning. We know that they've done pretty bad things. We know that the sons of Eli have not been behaving well. They've been violating the Karbonos and their power. And we know that Eli tried to give a bit of a rebuke, but he wasn't really putting his foot down as hard as he could have, it seems. And this is where we left. So into the scene, this a mysterious character. We're told the following: Vayavor Isha Elakim El Eli. So we have a man of God speaks to Eli. He approaches Eli. Vayomer Elov, and he says, Komar Hashem Haniglo Niglesi El Beis Avicha BeYosam BeMitzrayim NeBeis Avadim. Did I not appear to your parents' house, your forefathers, when I was in Egypt? And I chose your forefather to do all the priestly actions with me in my sanctuary. And I gave in his hand all the fire sacrifices of Israel. Why do you kick? Sort of like you reject my sacrifices, my animals, my meal offerings, which I commanded you to do in my mikdash. But instead, you made yourself healthy, you made yourself fat off the sacrifices of all of Israel. So there's no sound. There's no sound. Thank you, Danny. Thanks for checking. One second, let's just check. My mic is on. Just checking the live stream over here. Danny's just making sure there's no sound on the internet, apparently. Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you so much, Danny. So what we have over here is the introductory speech. And what's so strange about this whole business is that first of all, we have this anonymous Ish Elohim. Who is this person? Who could this person be, ladies? Right? So the suggestion, what was that? So, okay, good. So there's two suggestions. You see, like what we're doing over here is like this. This is what's called closed canon analysis. Closed canon means that we have a fixed amount of characters that we have, and the assumption is, in closed canon, is that we're not going to now start finding new people, but it must be somebody that we know already. So who else could have been of prophetic nature at this time? So there's two options that we really have, and you just said them. So Adina said it could have been Elkanah, and Karen was pointing out it could have been Pinchas. These are two prophets who did live around this time. So the Mefarshim actually gravitate towards Elkanah as being one of the prophets, and the question is, where Rashi says this, but the question is why not Pinchas? Why would it not be Pinchas? So let's sort of leave that question hanging. I think by the end of this conversation, it'll be clearer why it isn't Pinchas. Okay? Okay, yeah, but we do. Pinchas does seem to be this figure in the Pelegish Begiva battle where he represented God, and you kind of think that maybe he also, according to many of the Forshim, was this Malach Hashem at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, and he heralded certain tidings. So you know, like, so you could imagine him being this, being the mouthpiece of this as well. But nonetheless, they move away from this, and I'd like to just sort of leave that as a question for you: why it is that this couldn't be Pinchas, rather that it must be an Elkanah? If it's somebody we know already, okay. So nonetheless, so now we introduce this very tough conversation over here, it sounds like Elkanah, this Ish Elohim is saying that there was this time in Egypt where I revealed myself to you. Thank you, Danny. It was this time in Egypt where I revealed myself to you. When exactly did Hashem reveal himself to Eli and his family? Was there an incident that we can point to in Egypt where God was interacting with Eli or his predecessors? Can we think of anything like that? So it's interesting. So we're going to go back into, we'll try to get a little bit of history. It sounds like the Kohanim had a special status in the land of Egypt, which we're going to get to in just a moment. But we don't seem to really have an indicator in the Torah that Hashem spoke specifically to the Shevet Leviim or the Kohuna in Egypt. There wasn't like, but it sounds like he's referencing it. Did I not reveal myself to your ancestors, Eli, who is a Kohen? Which leads Rashi to say a very interesting thing. If I could draw your attention just in the unit 2.2, that's the packet over here, which is the supplementary sources, the supplementary Mefarshim. Rashi says in the third source, Hanigla Niglesi al Beis Avicha, Mikan, from here we see, Shenisnabei Aaron b'Mitzrayim. It must have been that Aaron actually had prophecy in Egypt. Aaron had prophecy in Egypt. Umahin Hanavua, what was that prophecy? Ushenemar Yechehi Koitze Cheskel, Vomar Alihem, Ish Shekutze Einov, there was, and this is what interesting what's happening over here. Yechezkel has a number of times, four times in Sefer Yechezkel, there are passages where Yechezkel does what's called a summary of history. So he says, you know, Israel, you've been bad since day one. Let me tell you why. And Yechezkel says, this is what happened here, and this is what happened there, and this is what happened there. And when you review Yechezkel's view of history, sometimes you see actual additional facts in history which we never saw beforehand. That means to say that it was probably irrelevant for us to know, let's say, in the Shmos telling of it. But Yechezkel, for the people he is addressing, the people who are being exiled into Babylon, for them they need to know this detail of the story. So he brings that up. So one of the details he brings up is that Aaron was already telling you, stop your polytheism, drop all those idols, right? Which gives us an indication that Egypt wasn't just us being a slave nation. We were really a idol-worshipping strata of society. Okay, so what Rashi is identifying for us is he's saying the following. I, God, spoke to you, meaning who's you? Your ancestors. Eli, who's your ancestor? Aaron. I spoke to you as the representative of my people, essentially. Aaron was my representative, and he spoke on my behalf to the people to rectify their ways. That was what you represented. How can you be rejecting that capacity? How can you now live a life and instead of being the person to correct the people, you are now the corrupt individual. You are letting your children run amok. That's what the Rashi understands is going on here. You see all the dots that Rashi had to connect? He had to go all the way back to Yechezkel to realize what was happening in Mitzrayim, and then realize that this Ish Elokim is referring to that event, which was known in history, but wasn't articulated until later on. Which is a very fascinating connection to have over here. We may try to smooth this out to a easier understanding in a few minutes. Okay, but nonetheless, this is what happens. You're my representative. You should be just doing something special, and instead, you rejected it. You are abusing your seat of power. The next, so what's the response to this? What's going to be the outcome of this? So the outcome is pretty devastating. So let's read the next three psukim. Lachein anum Hashem elokei Yisrael. So therefore says God, the power of Israel. Emor amarti beischo beisavicho yisalchu lifonai ad olam. I used to say, says the Ish Elokim, that you and your father's house, you Eli and your lineage would be eternal. Va'atonu Hashem chalili ki mimichabdai achabedu vozai yekolu. No. I respect those who respect me, and those who disgrace me, I disgrace. There are going to be days which are going to come. I'm going to break your power. I'm going to break the power of your father's house from ever being a zaken, a respected old person in your house. You're going to see the temple, the Chol Asher Yetiv Es Israel, while Hashem is doing good for Israel. But you'll never have old people in your family. Why? They'll always die young. They'll all die young. I'm not going to cut away a person from my altar to end your eyes to in mourning. And most of the people are going to die as people in their prime. Okay, so a very terrible curse which is paid over the house of Eli for not guarding his children. That's a very severe curse. You know, like why? What is the? Is there some type of quid pro quo here? Is there some type of cause effect that we can identify in this? Can we think of anything that would warrant this type of punishment? The early ending or the early demise of these children. Where else do we have earliness in the story? So what was that? Great. So Rashi says exactly what I said. Is that what happens was that the children of Eli would ask or demand the food of God. They would demand part of the sacrifice before it was even sacrificed. Meaning, they came before God. So God says, you know what? If you don't have a sense of time boundary, if you're rushing that mark, he says, you know what? I'm not going to let you get to the mark of your life. Right? Rashi's saying there's a greater, darker side to the rush. When there's no boundaries, then the boundaries fall apart again. Which is the way that Rashi understands this, which is a very sad reflection of this. This is all a very severe punishment. You need to understand why and how. What does it mean? What does it mean when it says "b'chol asher yetiv"? You know, when in this psukim it says, "When I'm doing good to Israel." What do you think that means? When is this all going on? When is this curse taking effect? What's the time stamp on this curse then? Right, so Sardinus in the sources in the Radakia, which is to be found in source. The Radakia is to be found in source 6. The Radak says, "B'chol asher yetiv, v'chol atov asher yetiv Hashem es Yisrael k'shiyivne habayis." When Hashem will allow you to build the temple in the times of Shlomo HaMelech, that's when yenikle zracha yenikle. That's when your power will be destroyed. Sham yihi sham shiyeh gadol aleihem v'hem tefelim la'acherim. Everybody else will be on the upward swing, and you'll be on the downward swing. So apparently, as the Beis Hamikdash is being built, that's when the curse will come in. And in fact, the Mefarshim point to a historical episode where Eviasar, who is the Kohen from the family of Eli, is deposed of and replaced by Tzadok. Okay, and there's a specific moment in history where we know that the family shift occurs, and this curse takes effect. Which is what this is predicting at the time when B'chol Asher Yetiv, as Israel's on the upswing, all Kohanim on the upswing, that's when Eli's house meets its unfortunate and continual early demise. Very sad continuation. And that's the particular event that we're referring to over here. In fact, that's what the Radak says in the next source, in source 7. He says, "I'm going to make for me a trusted priest." He says, "Amru kizet tzadok ki lo chala al zera alai haklala ad shenas et tzadok koin gadol." This never really occurred. This curse sort of was waiting in limbo until the day until tzadok became the koin gadol in the place of Eviasar. Tzadok was from the family of Elazar HaKohen, and Eli's family was from the family of Itamar. So two different branches of Aaron's different sons. And this is when the changeover took effect historically. Very sad state of affairs. We continue to see, so this Ishel Akim now gives us the proof. So the Ishel Akim is now going to conclude with what happened over here. And he says the following, we're going through Pasuk Lamed Dalet to Lamed Vav. V'zelecha ha'ois, and this is the sign, Asher Yavoi, Es shnevonecha el chafni ve'upinchas b'yom echad yamusu shneim. Your two children, who are really the cause of this whole matter, right? They're really the protagonists of this whole episode, are going to die, but they're not just going to die early, they're going to die on the same day. When you see that happen, Eli, you'll know that now the cogs are in motion and the decree has started. Okay, that's how you're going to know it. Like mostly koi neeman, and I'm going to establish a priest who is believed or faithful. Kasher bilvavi uvinafshi yase, who'll do like my heart and what I really want, what Kashem wants. Uvonisi loy vayis neeman, and I'll make for him a faithful home. Meaning, if he's faithful to me, I'll make a faithful home to him. I'll give him the adolam, the eternity. Vizalech rivnei meshichi kol hayomim, and he will walk in front of my appointed one all the days. Who's his appointed one? Who's God's appointed one? Refers to? Who's the Mashiach Hashem? It is, but more generally it is a king. Okay, so David is the Mashiach Hashem in this particular instance, but it's all of David's Davidic dynasty of the so he's going to be the leader in tandem with David. And those who remain in your house, your will come to bow down to him. To whom? Well, I think it actually refers over here to that Kohen Neeman who's replacing you. Now, about right, la goras kesef kikar lechem. To get, it sounds like food money. They need food, and they're going to beg for food from him. Please give me a little bit of the service of the kohen to allow me to get bread, to allow me to be sustained. That's the curse or the turn of the wheel of fortune here in the bigger scheme of things. In fact, the Ralbag says it's not only that they were just going to be famished in terms of provisions, in terms of life food. It's actually referring to even worse than that psychologically. Listen to what the Ralbag says in the last source on this page, in source eight. The Ralbag says in this pasuk, "Yavol ishtach avoy zol agoras kesav kikar lechem rotzel omar." This means to say, "Shivakish loy shiyim yishiyim shehu." He says, you know what? You're going to ask and you're going to beg to be among the Kohanim who can even serve in the Beis Hamikdash because you've been rejected. Right? You're going to ask, it's not that you're just looking for money. It's that you're looking to be able to come close again. You are at the top of everything and now you don't even have a foothold in the service. So he markes the kikar lechem. Yaspik lo liroso sheyachbaru ala achas mimishmaras kohanet kedei sheyagilu mimimu ma'at lechem. You just want to be able to serve God so you can actually earn the food to put on your table, which is how the Kohanim worked, and even that is not going to be available to you. This is the curse of Eli. A very, very sad story. It's interesting to note that we don't see any response right now from Eli. Eli's just very quiet. We're going to see this as it doubles back in just a moment, hopefully next week. Jesse, and that's the end of the parak, yeah.
Am I reading too much into the language? When I feel like there's some sort of mirror to, like, Shema there. Like the days, and they're talking about, you know, there's, I don't know, they're just kind of like hints to this language there, and like talking about like an oath, and then keep talking about houses. I just feel like some of the language is parallel, and the message is parallel.
Right, you're saying the second paragraph, right?
Yeah.
Where it's sort of like the Hashem sort of says, if you do this, this is what's going to happen. If you don't do this, this is what's going to happen over here. And it's going to be, it's pretty much, you know, good and bad and life and death in very, very clear, very clear terms. I hear you. I need to go through this a little more because I have a higher call. We need to go through like a fine tooth comb and sort of see all the parallels. But you're right. It's set up in a very stark and very clear delineated fashion. I mean, which is so you know, Eli, you're saying that the unfortunate part about this is it's different from Shema in the sense that it's too late. It sounds like, you know, meaning the Shema is speaking to all of us on a daily basis and saying, folks, you have the choice individually or communally. But this is not saying you have the choice anymore. This is saying you've made the choice. And that's the sad part about this is like, you know, we're already stuck and we're going to see now that in fact it's going to come to be when Eli's two children die on the same day and we're going to know that this sticks into motion. What I'd like to do is now, just having covered the response, we've seen now essentially three perspectives. This is just an important thing to notice. We've seen three perspectives on the sins of Eli, right? We've seen the Tanakh describe it. We've seen Eli describe it to them in his rebuke to them. And now we've seen the Ish Elohim describe what they did wrong. Okay, so just in terms of voices, we're watching the same episode being described with three different voices. What I'd like to do is ask the following question. Who is the victim in each of those three voices? Now we're going to move on to, if you turn the page to the next page, I'm going to go through Eon 1, the role of the priest. To turn this back, to turn back the clock into a bigger picture. Who are the victims over here? Okay, so let's do a brief recap. The way the Tanakh describes the victims itself, when it describes what's happening as the narrator of Tanakh, which is Shmuel in this case, is describing what is the description. Who are the victims of the sons of Eli's crime? Let's do a quick recap. Who are they? What was that? So any individual bringing a korban was now essentially at the whim of the Bnei Eli, who could decide that they want to take the meat early, or they want to take more meat, or whatever else their demands were, right? So that's one set of victims. Who else? Well, Eli is sort of like, I would say it's collateral damage. You know what I mean? It affects him as his status. You're right. That's an interesting point. But the Tanakh isn't, at this point in time, when it describes what they're doing, it's describing like who's suffering because of what their actions right now. Like, you know, before we get to the So Minchat Hashem, so who's the victim there, so to speak?
God,
meaning so in a certain sense, what they're doing is when they're cheating these people, they're not just cheating these people, they're cheating God as well. You know, God's also, so to speak, a victim of their crime, their crime as well. And there's also another group of people, and that is the Kohanim get cheated also, but that's sort of a certain the collateral damage. More specifically, it's also the remnant of the women. Okay, so whether their korbanos are late and they can't return home, or whether there is illegitimate behavior going on, the group of women who are tzav ois at the entrance of the oil mode are also victims of their crimes. But so we see a number of different stages of victimhood as described explicitly. And of course, as you pointed out, there are collateral damages. The Kohanim, Eli, the priesthood, right? Which are being affected. Now, when Eli turns to his children and Eli rebukes them, what does he really catch them on? What was the point that bothered him the most? Okay, so this is now, let's look at his voice. Doing this is, it sounds like that really he's most concerned with God. But how do we know this? Let's look at the words that he says on just in source 3 in the Eon page. We are on Eon 1, the role of the priesthood. The priest, this is in the packet that's new from today. Okay, it says the Eon 1 on the top of the page. It's on page 6. And it says, let's look at source 3. This is what Eli says under the heading, what Eli accused them of doing. He says, Im yechta ish le'ish upila lo elokim. Look, when humans have a riff, then what's going to end up happening? You know what? They can adjudicate it. They'll get somebody to deal with it, and they'll work it out. If you sin against God, there's no one who's going to advocate on your behalf. So what is it? What's Eli saying essentially?
You're cooked.
He's saying, so what's worse? You're cooked. But what's the problem? Who should you be most concerned about?
God.
He's saying that your greatest and gravest sin was what you did to God. What's he less concerned about? He seems less concerned about the human victims. Okay, he seems less concerned about the people who lost their korbanos, or meat, or early, or the women. That's not really part of Eli's equation when he's trying to put his foot down on the sons of Eli. Isn't it interesting? The way he's framing it is different from the way that Tanakh framed it. Okay, in terms of the difference of voice. Let's move to the third voice over here. And now we come up to our Ish Elokim. What is the Ish Elokim going to correct? Right. So what would we expect him to be correcting? So what does he have to make up for now? What does he have to correct Eli? Because when Eli's just finished giving rebuke, the rebuke has not worked. So this Ish Elokim now needs to add in the human component. Right. It's clear that what's missing over here is the human victim component. So let's read his words very carefully again and see if that might be what he's saying. Okay, so let's read this carefully. So in the first place, this is in source 4. Take a look how it describes it. These are the psukim which I said a moment ago. Lomo tiv'atu bezivchi uv'minchasi ashetzivi sima'on. Why are you kicking? You are disgracing the offerings that are brought to my place. So who's the victim over there?
God.
V'atachabedes bonecho mimeni, you honored your sons more than me, meaning because you didn't sufficiently rebuke them. L'havriachem, l'havriachem, mereshis kominchas Yisrael la'ami. To make yourselves healthy, to gain, sort of put on weight, off what? Off the sacrifices of Israel. Who's the victim over there?
Israel.
Isn't it interesting? He's not saying, you may read this initially and saying, well, no, he's talking about how they're taking away from the korbanos. No. He's saying, you're disgracing my sacrifices, but you're also depleting what other people were bringing. You took away from my nation, my Israel. You understand? Who's the victim over here, which you missed out, Eli, was the people. That's what you also missed out. It's a dual purpose. Interestingly enough, if you actually count through the words of this description over here, Ami Yisrael appears 6 times in the rebuke of the Ish Elokim. He keeps mentioning, my nation, Israel. Why does he need that? Because that's what's missing in Eli's worldview of what's happening to his sons. And that's perhaps the fallacy of Eli. Interestingly enough, later on we're going to see that when the Mishkan is destroyed, the news which shatters Eli more than anything else is the fact that the Aron is taken and not that people are killed, not even that his sons are killed. We're going to see later on. Which means to say, in his worldview, what was the concern? Eli was such a holy individual that his life was seen through the prism of the relationship with him and
God.
That's all. That was almost to the eclipse of anything else. Which is why, you know, that was the tragedy to him. His sons, the Aaron was taken, right? The what do you do to the sacrifices? What the Israelites is gently, or maybe not so gently, doing is shifting him back into focus. That no. There's actually two dimensions to this to this egregious error. Now let's yes, Helene.
They have already grown men, right? And a father could tell his children what they're doing wrong. If they don't listen, Hashem is blaming Eli as well.
You're right. Well, you know, it is interesting. There's a lot of ways you could think about this. You know, you could say, this is a very hard question to answer. There's lots of things we could consider. You know, one consideration is, you know, ultimately, where did that come from, that they grew up in such a way? You know, that's the one question we could ask. But Eli is a very holy individual. But that's one question we could ask. You know, that meaning, where were the seeds for that in the childhood? But also, if you think about it, the punishment is, who's it really affecting? You know, meaning, the punishment isn't that Eli's going to die early. Eli lives to a ripe old age of 99, or I think. Eli lives a good old age. Who are the people who are really punished early are? His children and their great-great-grandchildren, essentially.
Which does
affect Eli, you're right. But ultimately, in a certain sense, if the carriers of the baton, as I was saying in South Africa, the baton, if the carriers of the baton mess up, the race can't continue. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, if somebody along the relay race decides that they're going to have lunch, then all the people following is going to lose lunch, even the race, even though the first people did an excellent job getting there, right? Which sounds like a little bit what's going on over here, which sort of just puts the gravity on how important it is, you know, this thing. But you're right, it's a very troubling issue. Nonetheless, part of the concern over here is Eli's worldview, which seems to be being questioned over here. Let's take that a little further in the following sense.
Can I ask?
Yeah, sure.
As the Kohen Gadol, could he dismiss his sons and take away their ability to be a Kohen?
I don't know. Apparently, he was expected to have done something stronger earlier. I don't know if he has the right to re-anoint or change the track of things. I'm not 100% sure on that question, because you're saying, what's the alternative, right, Ellen?
If they're bad, then could he have done something?
Right. There must have been. It sounds like there must have been something, and I don't know what that something exactly was.
Wait, can I just ask you a quick question?
Sure.
I'm sorry. Stupid question, but I'll understand things better once I know this. Being a Kohen is passed on.
Yes.
So you're not chosen to be a Kohen.
Correct.
It's like being a king.
Right.
So nobody's chosen, I guess that's my question, nobody is chosen to be a Kohen. You have to be in the line.
Right.
Right? That's the only way.
Right. Okay. So you're right. That is true. It happens to be that these are the Kohanim Gadolim, so they have an extra special lineage running through them. But I'd like to actually address your question in the following question, is let's go back to their chosenness. Let's ask exactly that question, Karen. Let's say, well, when were Kohanim chosen? When do we start seeing that they were unique among Israel? And maybe that'll give us an idea as to what their role is. Okay, so when was the first place that they were chosen? The Ishalakim tells us.
In Mitzrayim.
The Ishalakim told us, didn't I give Nevuah to your great-great-great-great-grandfathers in Egypt, right? Which means to say that the first time we see priests being different and special and chosen is Egypt. What was their special status? We were just talking about that a moment beforehand. Where did that special status come from? What was it, and where did it come from? What was their special status? Okay, so we know from Yechezkel that Aaron, or one of them, was a messenger of Nevuah, right? So that's what we seem to see from Yechezkel. But more than that, we know a little more than that as well. It seems from many midrashim that, and based on Sukkim, from many midrashim that the Levium, that whole tribe, actually weren't subjugated in Egypt. Interestingly enough, they weren't part of the Shibud Mitzrayim. How do we know this? So the Midrash knows this from, if you go back to the end of Sefer Bereishis, you will see something very interesting. At the end of Sefer Bereishis, where we're told that when Yosef was in charge of Egypt, take a look at in source 7 for a moment. In source 7, these are the laws that Yosef laid down in the land of Egypt. But this is the, remember, just to contextualize, this is the time when the famine is so severe that everybody is coming to Egypt, to the granaries, to get food. And everybody runs out of money to pay for the food. So Yosef therefore says, we'll subjugate yourselves, we'll buy you, so you can have food. And essentially, Egypt became the superpower owning not just land, but people themselves, so that they could actually live. Okay? Talk about government control, right? So in those days, what happens? But in and amongst those laws, he made a law till today, meaning a longer lasting law. We know that, in fact, the people he did not tax or take the land from was the priestly tribe. Now, the priestly tribe weren't referring to the Kohanim of the Jews or the Israelites. He's referring to the Egyptian priests. Right? This is where parsonage started, right? Just going a few psukim back in the next source, Rakad Mazakhanim lo kana, that he didn't do that. Ki choik la kohanim eis paro. Yosef set into motion a set of laws that the priesthood would be different. That would be special. The Ramban, the way the Ramban describes this is he says that this is actually this was part of Hashem's divine plan. Meaning, whether Yosef knew or didn't know it, Yosef was really laying the framework or the groundwork for Israel to survive. Because if wasn't one bastion of free part of Israel, there would be nothing left. There would be no even, you know, vestiges of what it meant to be part of the Abrahamic family. So there was one little enclave, which, and how did they get around? They ducked under the law, which essentially protected the priesthood class of society. The problem with this is first of all, was there an action they did to warrant this? Meaning, was there something that the priestly tribe did in Egypt to warrant this protection? Not particularly, right? Up to this point in time, it wasn't that they got this extra affordance because they did something. It was just because. That's just how they were. And what's the danger of having such a unique status in society? What's the flip side of that? What could go wrong with this?
You can abuse it.
You could abuse it, but even more subtly than abuse it. If you're living, you're a Levite, living in Egypt, and you are essentially free from the taxing work of your neighbors, what ends up happening to you? What's the danger of that?
Oh, you're separated.
You don't have you're separated. You don't have a sense of what's going on with the rest of your brethren. You live a different lifestyle. You live a detached lifestyle. You may even live, if you want to go that so far as to say, an apathetic lifestyle, right, to the society around you. They've got a special status, but the special status is, in fact, distinct. There's a danger with distinction. That's, by the way, in fact, the Midrashim, the Ramban quotes the Midrash, which is very interesting. The Pasuk tells us, "Kasher yanu asoy ken yirbeva ken yifrots." As they were afflicted, that's how much they would multiply. Hashem was allowing their fertility to be the counteraction for the affliction. Right? That's the way Hashem set up the system, the beginning of Sefer Shmos. The Ramban says that accounts for the very modest number of Levim when you do the desert counts. Meaning most of the tribes have, you know, 40, 50, 60,000 people, or men between certain ages. Levian 20s are very much lower. Why? Says the Ramban, because since they weren't afflicted, they didn't also have the extra blessing of fertility. Meaning they weren't kasher yanu asar, they weren't part of the suffering in the same way. There's a danger that comes with it. Who's the first person to break out of that?
Moshe.
Moshe is also a Levite. He grows up by Yetze, and he goes out to see the suffering of his brothers. Moshe becomes the Levite who breaks through the wall, that glass wall of, we'll call it privilege, to be able to appreciate what's going on with his brothers. And he gets a seat of leadership, not because, just because, or because of past laws. He gets a seat of leadership because of his care about his brothers. Right, when he's walking in Midian and he sees a burning bush, he starts thinking about, as the Midrash says, he starts thinking about the suffering of his brothers. That means to say that in the forefront of his mind was his concern for the nation, even though he wasn't part of their suffering. That's something, he grew up in the king's palace after all. He was a very happy Egyptian. Nonetheless, that sets the tone for the movement into the next stage of Levium. You see, there's a few examples of where this, of the new chosenness of the Levium, and let's take a look at a few of them. Later on, at the times of the Egel HaZahav, What happens is that Hashem says, look, Moshe, these folks, you know, it was great, but up till now, and now, you know, I'm going to destroy them, Moshe. They're 39 days from the most incredible national revelation. They're already dancing around a idol. You know, this is it. I'm going to destroy them all. I'm going to start again from you. What's Moshe Rabbeinu's response? Moshe Rabbeinu's response is, No, it's all or nothing. It's either me with them or not. I'm going down with the ship. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu says. Moshe Rabbeinu could have said, thank you very much. Nobody else would know. The reporters weren't so active in those days. That would be a new nation. Fantastic. All my children, and he'd be the patriarch. Nope. Moshe Rabbeinu says, Mecheni nami sifrucha. Meaning the care that he had for the other people was even when other people wouldn't know about it. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu says. What does he do? In order to mitigate the anger of God, which is now imminent, and there has to be repercussions for what happens, what does Moshe Rabbeinu do? He goes to the entrance of the camp and he says the words, Mila Hashem Elai, who's going to be to God for me? This was essentially a purge of the people who had sinned to be able to save the rest, right? And who responds? The whole of Shevet Levi. So now we see something interesting emerging. We see the emergence of a Shevet, which in Egypt could have been a distinct and separate Shevet, who, for all we know, really had very little to do with their brothers. For the first time over here, now join forces with the Moshe figure in the care for the brothers. Now, this is a very interesting care, because their care involves cutting out the disease, right? There's a diseased part of this nation. They need to cut out that disease for the rest of the nation to survive. Okay, there was not a massive number of people killed, but the sinners were killed, and that allowed the anger of God to take its place, take its hold, and the rest of the people could survive, which is a model we'll see a little later. Okay, so what happens is now we have a new model of Levi, and Levi who's chosen not because of the past, but because of actions, which is why we see in Sefer Bamidbar, listen to the description that we have over here in Sefer Bamidbar, Perek Ches. This is in source 14. It says, so Hashem says, look, I want you to count all the tribes. This is the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. And you're going to count everybody. And there's going to be this special arrangement which is going to happen. You're going to take the firstborns. And you're going to do a switch, one for one, man for man, within a particular age range. And the Levim are going to, so to speak, take the position of leadership that the Bechorim did take. So here we go. He says, they're going to be to whom? Bahayu? Li Halavim. The Levim will be to me. Who do they belong to? They belong to God. Okay? They're given to whom? They're given to God. Okay? Then if you skip down to Pasuk Yud Tes, now who are they given to? Aaron and his children for what? Mitoch b'nei Yisrael, avodis, avodis b'nei Yisrael, bo'olam o'od, l'chaper al b'nei Yisrael. V'lo yiyeh b'nei Yisrael negev, b'geshes b'nei Yisrael al ha'kodesh. Now they're not only just given to me, nesunim sim hemali, they're given to you to represent whom? To represent Israel, right? Because now they're going to atone for Israel, they're going to bring the korbanos of Israel on their behalf to avoid there being a plague. Doesn't that sound familiar? What did they do before? Over here, the simple pshat is that they're going to stop people coming in and crossing lines that they shouldn't cross, which would hurt them, right? But where else did they essentially make boundaries to save people was at the Egel Azov, where they made boundaries to be able to protect the people for their greater good. Be'geshes al HaKodesh, where they try to come too close to the holy in the wrong way. So what happens? Because of that episode, it sounds like, we're having, now the Levim are being re-inaugurated. They're given to whom? To two sets of entities. They're on the one hand the representative of God, and then on the other hand they're the representative of also Israel. Do you see what's happening over here? The re-inauguration of the Levium is not simply as a class set aside because they're godly. They're a set of people who are now unique in that they are both godly and human representatives. How did they get that extra appellation? Because that's exactly what they did. They felt responsibility for their brethren. They became this bridge character. The way the Gemara describes it is when asking this question is, are Kohanim, which is a subclass of Levi, are they Shluchei Didan or Shluchei Derachmona? Are they our representatives? They bring our korbanos, they sing in the Mikdash on our behalf. Or are they Shluchei Derachmona, or are they representing God? That's the question. The Gemara leaves it somewhat unresolved because they really have both those elements to it. This leads us to now the last and most interesting twist of the story. You see, because We moved from an Egyptian class of priest, so to speak, which were just because that was their status, moving towards a priesthood which was gained through involvement in community, through sacrifice for the sake of community, which gave them this unique status of Nisonim, Nisonim, Hemali, Nisonim, Levanov, right? This dual status. And then we meet somebody else who does a very similar thing. Who else also kills in order to be able to protect Israel?
Pinchas.
There's another person called Pinchas. So Pinchas later on, in the end of Parshas Balak, beginning of Parshas Pinchas, kills Zimri in order to abate the plague which is continuing in Israel because of the incest which is going on between Israel and the daughters of Moab and Midian. And upon that killing, he stops the plague, right? So once again, here is a person from the Levite, now even more specifically, the Kohen branch of the Levites, and he is taking action on behalf of the other people. What is he afforded because of that? He's afforded something called Bris Kohunas Olam. He's given eternal priesthood because he is the greatest exemplifier of that notion of care of both God and humans, right? And that connection. He represents that bridge, that earned place that the Levium had earned. So now let's bring it to full fruition. Historically speaking, who were the Kohanim? Who were the Kohanim Gedolim up till this point throughout Sefer Shoftim? Not really clear, right? We don't really know about it. So listen to this last really unbelievable Rashi, and with this we'll close. Rashi says in the very last source, he says the following: Omar Amarti Beischa Beisavicha VeGomer. This is in source 15 on the bottom, page 7. Mitzchila Nosati Kuhuna Gedola LeElazar Hakohen. At the beginning, the Kuhuna Gedola, the great priesthood, was given to the Elazar. That was the son of Aaron. Remember when Aaron died, the person who came up the mountain to unclothe Aaron and take his garments was his son Elazar. And Elazar assumed the role, because remember Aaron had four children, two died. There was Elazar in Tamar who remained. Okay, Elazar was the one who took the priesthood. Shenemar vavshet Aaron is begadov v'gomer. Ubimei pilegish begiva shepokru Yisrael berov hamitzvos umigorom lahem Pinchas. So what happens? Who is the son of Elazar? Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron Kohen. Pinchas assumed the role of Kohen Gadol because, and where did he earn that? Because of his actions for the sake of Israel, where he killed and therefore assumed the role of high priesthood. He had that role until the end of Sefer Shoftim. Why till the end of Sefer Shoftim? Because society is running amok, and whose responsibility should that have been? The communally minded person, the Kohen. When society is falling apart, the responsibility lies on the heads of the leaders, a terrifying notion. And therefore was taken away from him. He and his family should have actually made pilgrimages to different cities and spoke to people and said, what's going on? Why aren't there judges? Why are things like this? Why are the incidents like this occurring in your cities, in your villages? That's what Pinchas' responsibility was, meaning a Kohen is a communally-minded individual. When he lost that sense of communal-mindedness, says Rashi, it was taken away from him. He was no longer the Kohen Gadol. And I gave it to you. Eli was from the children of the other son of Aaron, Itamar. Right? The two remaining sons of Aaron. It moved from Elazar's seat of power to Itamar. Why? Because Pinchas wasn't living up to what his namesake was supposed to be. And I said to myself that maybe you'll have it forever. I wanted to give it to you forever. However, the next Rashi says, I will honor those who honor me. I'm going to honor those who honor me like Pinchas in Shittim. That's where he killed Zimri. And so what happens? The Ishlakim is saying the following. This was an experiment. Up till now, Pinchas, who really showed his mettle, became the Kohen Gadol and his children. What happened? It became clear that he wasn't living up to his capacity as what a Kohen is supposed to be, thinking about the community and thinking about God, representing both directions. He lost that. It was taken to your family, Eli. Your family was supposed to be the person who could bridge God and the people. He could worry about society. What happened? What did your children do? They became people who are only concerned about ourselves. And Eli, when you rebuked them, what were you missing in your rebuke? You misunderstood the people. All you were worried about was God. All you were worried was about the korbanos. Says the Ish Elokim, you've lost it. You misunderstood the whole process. Therefore, what's going to happen? I'm going to take that kohen gadolah and take it away from you. Where's it going to go? Back to the hands of the children of Elazar. Back to the children of Tzadok, who comes from the family of Kohanim, from the other side of the family, from Elazar. Because you have to have a community-minded person who's in the seat of power. This, ladies, is perhaps why it is that it's so important to understand the concluding lines as it describes about Shmuel Hanavi himself. It's going to get the actual the psukim. When it describes Shmuel Hanavi at the end over here of this parak, just before the Ish Elokim appears, listen to the way it describes him. This is in Pasuk Chavov. Va'anar Shmuel, the young man Shmuel, holech v'godel v'tov, gam im Hashem v'gam im anashim. Shmuel was excelled in two areas. He excelled in the area of his relationship with God and the relationship with humans, because that is the necessary criterion in order to be able to succeed over here. Shmuel's the mirror opposite of what was going on and what Eli was understanding was going on. And that perhaps is the story over here. These are some of the ideas that today what we discussed, some of the ideas from Yigal Ariel. But actually, if you look a little earlier, it's actually the Malbim has a very, very coherent way of wording this as well. The Malbim on the words of the Ish Elokim as well, which is most beautiful. So next week we're going to now turn to the arrival of Shmuel into Nevuah. Thank you, ladies.